This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane. The Taliban's been telling the world it'd be more moderate and inclusive in its style of governing, yet none of that's been reflected in the interim government it's just unveiled in Afghanistan. It's an all-male lineup, many from the group's hardline rule for the 90s, and it includes a man wanted by the FBI for terrorism. ABC correspondent Nick Doll reports from Islamabad in neighbouring Pakistan.
In Kabul, Islamist fighters fire into the air as anti-Taliban protesters march through the streets. They had been yelling, "Long live the resistance and death to Pakistan," which they blame for supporting the Taliban. There were many women among the group, including a 19-year-old who asked AM not to identify her. She says life is getting much harder under the Taliban.
And here the life become so worse. And here this is too hard to be in life.
Many people listening to this would say that you are very brave as a young woman protesting against the Taliban in Kabul. Were you scared?
No. And I have to defeat for them, and I have to work for my country.
The 19-year-old says the announcement of a new government gives her little hope. She used to work as a program manager with a charity, but she says Taliban fighters are making that impossible.
They say that why you go outside, why you go to school, why you go to university, just stay at home.
The head of the new Taliban government will be Mullah Hassan Akhund. He's a former close aide to the Taliban's founder, Mullah Omar. And the interior minister will be Sarojuddin Haqqani. He heads the Haqqani Network, which the US says is a terrorist organisation. He's wanted by the FBI over the bombing of a Kabul hotel, and he's subject to US sanctions. The Taliban's brutal reputation around the world has seen aid to the country dry up. The World Health Organization says by the end of the week, up to 90% of the country's medical facilities will close because many donors aren't permitted to support the Taliban. Jens Lark is a UN humanitarian spokesman. He's urging the international community to pledge $800 million in aid to prevent a catastrophe.
Basic services in Afghanistan are collapsing, and food and other life-saving aid is about to run out. We urge international donors to support this appeal fast and generously.
The international community is hoping this Taliban government is more moderate than the last. US Secretary of State Antony Blinken is visiting Qatar, which has the Taliban's ear.
They've told the world that they intend to uphold the basic rights of the Afghan people, including women and girls. We'll be looking very, very carefully at that.
During the visit, he was put on the spot by a member of Afghanistan's all-female robotics team who've been airlifted to safety. She said her dreams had been shattered, and she asked him what his government planned to do for her country now that the US has pulled out.
What's your plan? What's your, the US government's plan for the future of the millions of the kids and children and women in Afghanistan?
Antony Blinken didn't reveal a plan, but he says the US won't forget those who've been left behind. This is Nick Doll in Islamabad reporting for AM.
For weeks, the New South Wales government's been trying to shift public attention to vaccination rates rather than the rising number of COVID infections and patients being admitted to hospital. Now some of the Sydney suburbs at the heart of the Delta outbreak have recorded some of the state's highest vaccination rates. As Gavin Coote reports, it's partly thanks to the determined efforts from multicultural leaders.
All sorts of tactics are being used to entice people to get vaccinated, including reworking a popular Bollywood song. Parwin Luthra is a community leader and owner of media company India Link.
There are not too many Indian Australians who have not heard about the savage effects of this Delta variant from their loved ones in India. The community got together and made sure the message to get vaccinated was loud and clear.
These targeted and creative efforts to encourage people to get vaccinated are paying off. In the Blacktown local government area in Sydney's west, more than 86% of people 16 and older have had at least one dose.
10% of the Blacktown LGA is of Indian origin. And with the experience which the Indian community has experienced with family and friends in India, it's no surprise that Blacktown has one of the highest rates of vaccinations.
In Sydney's southwest, where there have been hundreds of COVID cases a day for months, vaccination rates had been well behind other areas until recently. Now the rate of first doses in Canterbury-Bankstown is more than 76%, and that includes about 7,000 people who've been vaccinated outside the Lekemba Mosque alone at a pop-up clinic run by the Lebanese Muslim Association. Khalid Alamadine is its general manager.
I believe that there's still some people asking for the vaccine, as I've been receiving so many calls, people asking for it.
And are there still some, do you think, that need a bit of talking through concerns they might still have about the vaccine?
There's minority, but the majority of the community are all okay with it. And after what they saw from their families and all these people got the COVID, they can see the effect of it and how harmful it is. So I believe majority are now trying to help that protect the whole society.
Further west in the Fairfield area, Lao community leader Bunthong Vonsaya has also organised a pop-up vaccine clinic. It'll start offering second doses of AstraZeneca from today. And he thinks the promise of more freedoms for fully vaccinated people is helping get many over the line.
Because there's some sort of hesitation from the community to get the jab at first place, and now to give incentive for people to come to help the community to make sure that we move to 70-80% vaccination for our people. That's a good incentive for people.
Statewide, it's expected 80% of eligible residents will have received at least one dose by early next week.
That report by Gavin Coote and David Sparks. The use of rapid COVID tests is set to be stepped up in the weeks ahead. It's expected the drug regulator, the TGA, will give the green light soon to allowing anyone to use one of the rapid antigen tests at home. In the meantime, it's provided a checklist for business to help guide employers about the types of tests available, how to give them to staff, and how reliable they are. Here's our senior business correspondent, Peter Ryan.
Rapid antigen tests are already being used by some big companies to manage COVID risk in the workplace. Banks and construction companies have been among the first to test staff, but what about the rest of the community? John Kelly, chief executive of the rapid test producer Atomo Diagnostics, says approval for wider testing is critical to building confidence that going to work, once fully vaccinated, can be safe.
In the early phases of the Sydney pandemic, you know, these tests would have been perfect to drop into, you know, every letterbox and try and screen the population to find the asymptomatic cases. At the moment, we haven't been able to secure self-test approval. And I think if the pandemic continues to escalate, you know, the government's going to have to consider ways to reach more people with testing, and self-testing is the easiest way to do that. In Germany, when you check out of Aldi, you get one to take home. The UK government sending tests home with school children to test two or three times a week to manage risk. You know, these uses are well proven overseas. And, you know, we're starting to now try and put these case studies to the government and try and see how they can be used more effectively in Australia.
The Therapeutic Goods Administration is reviewing the use of rapid tests with 28 approved so far. Health Minister Greg Hunt believes rapid home testing kits could be given the green light within months, if not weeks, but a spokesperson says that needs the support of states and territories. The tests currently have to be overseen by a healthcare professional, raising big questions for small businesses in particular who don't have the support of HR and legal departments.
There's obviously the cost of the rapid antigen testing kits themselves. Those costs can really build up.
Alexi Boyd is Chief Executive of the Council of Small Business Associations of Australia.
How do you test, say, half of your workforce one day and half another day? And what happens if those people have to come away from the workplace or they can't work for a few days while those tests are verified? And there's also the question about liability and another question about, well, whose responsibility is it to test our workers in the workplace environment?
Should businesses of all sizes take that responsibility to ensure that they operate safe workplaces?
Well, ultimately, yes. The responsibility of working, having a safe workplace does rest with the owner of the workplace itself. But this is a question about health. So we need some guidance from the government about whether the liability of testing should sit with the individual. Should you find out whether or not you're positive or negative before entering the workplace? Or should it be a requirement of entering the workplace to find out if you're positive or negative?
The TGA has published a checklist to help businesses understand the key considerations for rapid antigen tests in the workplace. Another challenge is that rapid tests are not as accurate in detecting COVID-19 as the standard PCR tests. A lot depends on an eight-week pilot program underway in New South Wales hotspots, which will be critical in building the case and confidence for rapid tests at home and at work.
Peter Ryan there. Hear the term shape-shifting and you might think it's just the stuff of speculative fiction, but a new review of published scientific data from around the world's found many animals are changing the shape of their bodies to cope with rising temperatures, and that includes some Australian birds. Nick Grimm reports.
Its song might sound pretty enough, but straight from the mouth of Australia's red-rumped parrot comes a dire warning to all the inhabitants of this planet, humans included. And while the gangang cockatoo's screech might often be compared to a rusty gate, from its beak too is a signal of how life is trying to adapt to a warming planet. In each case, the birds appear to have been gradually evolving the shape of their faces in response to a hotter environment, as researcher Sarah Riding from Deakin University explains.
So one of the more striking examples that we found are several species of Australian parrots. So, for example, gangang cockatoos and red-rumped parrots, which are both found throughout big parts of Australia, and these have increased their beak size by around 4 to 10% since the late 1800s.
And it's not just Australian birds showing the impact of climate change. From bats in China getting bigger wings to North America's tiny mole-like creature, the shrew, which has started growing a longer tail, warm-blooded creatures are trying to beat the heat by increasing the size of body parts that help lower their internal temperature. Researchers from Deakin University, the Australian National University, and Brock University in Canada have collaborated on a review of previously published studies, finding all kinds of animals showing similar signs of adapting to increased heat.
So specifically, we've been looking at whether animals are increasing the size of their appendages. So for example, beaks for birds or ears and tails for mammals, and whether they've been increasing the surface area of these appendages as a way to deal with the increased temperatures that climate change are bringing.
But Sarah Riding doesn't want anyone to misinterpret their findings.
I think people might listen to this and think, oh, great, animals are responding or evolving to deal with climate change. That means that they won't be affected by climate change. And I just want to say that, no, that's not true. And that's not what the takeaway message should be from this. And we don't know really how this is affecting their survival and other aspects of their ecology.
Deakin University researcher Sarah Riding. Nick Grimm reporting there. The New South Wales government is preparing to airdrop poisoned baits on land that falls within Sydney's main drinking water catchment. The baits are to control fox and dingo numbers to stop them competing with native wildlife for food sources that have been greatly reduced since the Black Summer bushfires a couple of years ago. Penny Timms reports from the specialist reporting team.
When the New South Wales government announced an expansion of its baiting program, Dr. Kylie Cairns, a conservationist and molecular biologist from the University of New South Wales, wanted to know more. She obtained internal government emails showing the baiting would be in what's known as the special areas of the Warragamba catchment. The catchment is the main source of drinking water for Sydney and lies within the Blue Mountains World Heritage Area.
I guess it was quite sort of shocking and surprising, really, to see how much baiting is being carried out and how it's not being carried out just at the perimeter of national parks, but it's being carried out quite far in, you know, like 5-10 kilometres even in some parts.
Special areas are buffers of mostly unspoilt native bushland upstream from dams designed to protect water quality. Around the Warragamba catchment, Schedule 1 areas are the most heavily protected, and entry to them is banned. They're surrounded by Scheduled 2 areas where entry is restricted, and it's in these places where the baiting is happening. Emails show the New South Wales Parks and Wildlife Service discussed whether the baits, laced with the poison 1080, could pose a risk.
And that really the risk to the water catchment is not so much in terms of 1080 getting into the water, because that would be unlikely, but more about the amount of carcasses that might get into the water supply and therefore foul up the water.
An email shows the Parks and Wildlife Service originally planned to also bait Schedule 1 areas, but abandoned that idea, saying, "We anticipate that there is a risk of community concern regarding the perceived risks of using 1080 in Sydney's drinking supply. For these reasons, we are proposing we don't bait in Schedule 1 lands." A spokesman for Water New South Wales, which manages the catchment, has told the ABC it considered the baiting only presented a very low risk thanks to other mitigating factors, including restricting baiting to greater than 200 metres from waterways. And there's another expert who thinks the benefits of baiting outweigh the risks, and that's Greg Misford, who's the National Wild Dog Management Coordinator, although he wasn't involved in this project.
Foxes are extremely adaptable, just like our other canine friends. They'll move into areas very quickly. On top of the other threatening processes on those threatened species like the brush-tailed wallabies, they'll cause significant impact in addition to an already stressed population from bushfire. So it's not surprising at all.
That's National Wild Dog Management Coordinator Greg Mifsud ending that report from Penny Timms and Michael Slezak. For generations, young Aussies have flocked to all corners of the globe for their gap year, seeking new experiences before taking up a job or further study. Sadly, that's not possible during the pandemic, but many are now trading international travel for an adventure in the Australian outback. Some are finding work on farms and cattle stations, learning new skills, and giving an agriculture sector that's starved of workers a much-needed boost. Matt Bamford reports.
A hot and dusty cattle station in Western Australia's remote north is about as far as you can get from a French boulevard or a Thai beach. But Ella Batten couldn't be happier.
So originally I was going to take my gap year overseas as well, and obviously plans had to be changed. And as much as COVID has been awful to everyone, I think the little blessing in disguise for me has been the fact that it pushed me to explore my own country.
The 18-year-old from Bunbury, south of Perth, arrived at Mount House Station with zero pastoral experience.
I don't know, I think the first week I was so tired every morning, and now, getting up at 4:30 is a breeze, so.
She's grown to love station life.
We have horses here, so we get to ride the horses and also a river, so we can go canoeing, but honestly, sometimes after just working all day, the best thing is just having a beer with everyone at the end of the day at dinner. We kind of came in and were just accepted straight away and basically been accepted like family. It's been really awesome.
It's an increasingly popular option for school leavers who can't travel overseas due to the pandemic.
I think it's opened a lot of people's eyes. This year with the rural industry just thumping away.
Dougald Storey is the director of Bush Recruitment, which finds staff for livestock stations and cropping properties. He says school leavers have become a valuable part of his business.
They're very important. Most of the people that are doing gap years, they kick off for the full season. So I have placed a few to start next year already, and there's quite a few more to go yet, yeah.
It's providing much-needed relief for short-staffed properties across regional Australia, struggling to replace foreign workers who've left during the pandemic. Linda Evans from Napier Down Station is one of many Kimberley pastoralists finding recruiting difficult. She recently lost one long-term staffer who returned to France for a funeral.
He's not been able to get back in since then, and now they've revoked his visa, so he no longer has access at all, which is really devastating for everyone because he was family and he was really handy kid too, and we'd spent quite a lot of money as a company getting Frenchie's sponsorship.
She wants more young Aussies to consider working and living in the regions.
Go for it, do it. It's an amazing world. It's a world where you'll learn a lot of skills that you'll never learn anywhere else, but you will. The most important part is you will develop friendships that will last you a lifetime.
That's Linda Evans from Napier Down Station, ending Matt Bamford's report. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Angela Farpierre.
And I'm Stephen Smiley, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal.
Mining royalties payments to First Nations people in the NT were meant to help close the gap. Instead, many say they're doing serious harm.
Today on The Signal, in the Northern Territory alone, more than $3 billion has been collected in royalties over the past 40 years. So why hasn't all that money lifted communities out of poverty? Look for The Signal on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.